her face and fashions, and even her feet, considered the most beautiful anyone had ever seen. And she had broken the heart of Lucien Bonaparte, the Emperor Napoleon's brother. Auguste liked his girls younger than Madame Récamier, and he had come to the chateau to rest. But those few moments in which she had stolen the scene with her sudden entrance caught him off guard. She was as beautiful as people had said, but more striking than her beauty was that look of hers that seemed so sweet, indeed heavenly, with a hint of sadness in the eyes. The other guests continued their conversations, but Auguste could only think of Madame Récamier. Over dinner that evening, he watched her. She did not talk much, and kept her eyes downward, but once or twice she looked up, directly at the prince. After dinner the guests assembled in the gallery, and a harp was brought in. To the prince's delight, Madame Récamier began to play, singing a love song. And now, suddenly, she changed. There was a roguish look in her eye as she glanced at him. The angelic voice, the glances, the energy animating her face sent his mind reeling. He was confused. When the same thing happened the next night, the prince decided to extend his stay at the chateau. In the days that followed, the prince and Madame Récamier took walks together, rode out on the lake, and attended dances where he finally held her in his arms. They would talk late into the night, but nothing grew clear to him. She would seem so spiritual, so noble, and then there would be a touch of the hand, a sudden flirtatious remark. After 2 weeks at the chateau, the most eligible bachelor in Europe forgot all his libertine habits and proposed marriage to Madame Récamier. He would convert to Catholicism, her religion, and she would divorce her much older husband. She had told him her marriage had never been consummated, and so the Catholic Church could annul it. She would then come to live with him in Prussia. Madame promised to do as he wished. The prince hurried off to Prussia to seek the approval of his family, and Madame returned to Paris to secure the required annulment. Auguste flooded her with love letters and waited. Time passed. He felt he was going mad. Then, finally, a letter. She had changed her mind. Some months later, Madame Récamier sent Auguste a gift. Gérard's famous painting of her reclining on a sofa. The prince spent hours in front of it, trying to pierce the mystery behind her gaze. He had joined the company of her conquests, of men like the writer Benjamin Constant, who said of her, "She was my last love. For the rest of my life, I was like a tree struck by lightning." Interpretation. Madame Récamier's list of conquests became only more impressive as she grew older. There was Prince Metternich, the Duke of Wellington, the writers Constant and Chateaubriand. For all of these men, she was an obsession, which only increased in intensity when they were away from her. The source of her power was twofold. First, she had an angelic face which drew men to her. It appealed to paternal instincts, charming with its innocence. But then there was a second quality peeking through in the flirtatious looks, the wild dancing, the sudden gaiety. All these caught men off guard. Clearly, there was more to her than they had thought, an intriguing complexity. When alone, they would find themselves pondering these contradictions as if a poison were coursing through their blood. Madame Récamier was an enigma, a problem that had to be solved. Whatever it was that you wanted, whether a coquettish she-devil or an unattainable goddess, she could seem to be. She surely encouraged this illusion by keeping her men at a certain distance so they could never figure her out. And she was the queen of the calculated effect, like her surprise entrance at the Chateau de Coppet, which made her the center of attention, if only for a few seconds. The seductive process involves filling someone's mind with your image. Your innocence, or your beauty, or your flirtatiousness can attract their attention, but not their obsession. They will soon move on to the next striking image. To deepen their interest, you must hint at a complexity that cannot be grasped in a week or two. You are an elusive mystery, an irresistible lure, promising great pleasure if only it can be possessed. Once they begin to fantasize about you, they are on the brink of the slippery slope of seduction and will not be able to stop themselves from sliding down. Artificial and natural. The big Broadway hit of 1881 was Gilbert and Sullivan's operetta, Patience, a satire on the bohemian world of aesthetes and dandies that had become so fashionable in London. To cash in on this vogue, the operetta's promoters decided to invite one of England's most infamous aesthetes to America for a lecture tour, Oscar Wilde. Only 27 at the time, Wilde was more famous for his public persona than for his small body of work. The American promoters were confident that their public would be fascinated by this man, whom they imagined as always walking around with a flower in his hand. But they did not expect it to last. He would do a few lectures, then the novelty would wear off, and they would ship him home. The money was good, and Wilde accepted. On his arrival in New York, a customs man asked him whether he had anything to declare. "I have nothing to declare," he replied, "except my genius." The invitations poured in. New York society was curious to meet this oddity. Women found Wilde enchanting, but the newspapers were less kind. The New York Times called him an aesthetic sham. Then, a week after his arrival, he gave his first lecture. The hall was packed. More than 1,000 people came, many of them just to see what he looked like. They were not disappointed. Wilde did not carry a flower and was taller than they had expected, but he had long, flowing hair and wore a green velvet suit and cravat, as well as knee breeches and silk stockings. Many in the audience were put off as they looked up at him from their seats. The combination of his large size and pretty attire were rather repulsive. Some people openly laughed. Others could not hide their unease. They expected to hate the man. Then he began to speak. The subject was the, quote, English Renaissance, the, quote, art for art's sake movement in late 19th century England. Wilde's voice proved hypnotic. He spoke in a kind of meter, mannered and artificial, and few really understood what he was saying, but the speech was so witty, and it flowed. His appearance was certainly strange, but overall, no New Yorker had ever seen or heard such an intriguing man. And the lecture was a huge success. Even the newspapers warmed up to it. In Boston, a few weeks later, some 60 Harvard boys had prepared an ambush. They would make fun of this effeminate poet by dressing in knee breeches, carrying flowers, and applauding far too loudly at his entrance. Wilde was not the least bit flustered. The audience laughed hysterically at his improvised comments, and when the boys heckled him, he kept his dignity, betraying no anger at all. Once again, the contrast between his manner and his physical appearance made him seem rather extraordinary. Many were deeply impressed, and Wilde was well on his way to becoming a sensation. The short lecture tour turned into a cross-country affair. In San Francisco, this visiting lecturer on art and aesthetics proved able to drink everyone under the table and play poker, which made him the hit of the season. On his way back from the West Coast, Wilde was to make stops in Colorado and was warned that if the pretty boy poet dared to show up in the mining town of Leadville, he would be hung from the highest tree. It was an invitation Wilde could not refuse. Arriving in Leadville, he ignored the hecklers and nasty looks. He toured the mines, drank and played cards, then lectured on Botticelli and Cellini in the saloons. Like everyone else, the miners fell under his spell, even naming a mine after him. One cowboy was heard to say, "That fellow is some art guy, but he can drink any of us under the table and afterwards carry us home two at a time." Interpretation. In a fable he improvised at dinner once, Oscar Wilde talked about some steel filings that had a sudden desire to visit a nearby magnet. As they talked to each other about this, they found themselves moving closer to the magnet without realizing how or why. Finally, they were swept in one mass to the magnet's side. Then the magnet smiled, for the steel filings had no doubt at all but that they were paying that visit of their own free will. Such was the effect that Wilde himself had on everyone around him. Wilde's attractiveness was more than just a byproduct of his character. It was quite calculated. An adorer of paradox, he consciously played up his own weirdness and ambiguity, the contrast between his mannered appearance and his witty, effortless performance. Naturally warm and spontaneous, he constructed an image that ran counter to his nature. People were repelled, confused, intrigued, and finally drawn to this man who seemed impossible to figure out. Paradox is seductive because it plays with meaning. We are secretly oppressed by the rationality in our lives, where everything is meant to mean something. Seduction, by contrast, thrives on ambiguity, on mixed signals, on anything that eludes interpretation. Most people are painfully obvious. If their character is showy, we may be momentarily attracted, but the attraction wears off. There's no depth, no contrary motion to pull us in. The key to both attracting and holding attention is to radiate mystery. And no one is naturally mysterious, at least not for long. Mystery is something you have to work at, a ploy on your part, and something that must be used early on in the seduction. Let one part of your character show so everyone notices it. In the example of Wilde, this was the mannered affectation conveyed by his clothes and poses, but also send out a mixed signal, some sign that you're not what you seem, a paradox. Don't worry if this underquality is a negative one, like danger, cruelty, or amorality. People will be drawn to the enigma anyway, and pure goodness is rarely seductive. Keys to Seduction. Nothing can proceed in seduction unless you can attract and hold your victim's attention, your physical presence becoming a haunting mental presence. It is actually quite easy to create that first stir, an alluring style of dress, a suggestive glance, something extreme about you. But what happens next? Our minds are barraged with images, not just from media, but from the disorder of daily life. And many of these images are quite striking. You become just one more thing screaming for attention. Your attractiveness will pass, unless you spark the more enduring kind of spell that makes people think of you in your absence. That means engaging their imaginations, making them think there is more to you than what they see. Once they start embellishing your image with their fantasies, they are hooked. This must, however, be done early on, before your targets know too much and their impressions of you are set. It should occur the moment they lay eyes on you. By sending mixed signals in that first encounter, you create a little surprise, a little tension. You seem to be one thing, innocent, brash, intellectual, witty, but you also throw them a glimpse of something else, devilish, shy, spontaneous, sad. Keep things subtle. If the second quality is too strong, you will seem schizophrenic. But make them wonder why you might be shy or sad underneath your brash intellectual wit, and you will have their attention. Give them an ambiguity that lets them see what they want to see. Capture their imagination with little voyeuristic glimpses into your dark soul. The Greek philosopher Socrates was one of history's greatest seducers. The young men who followed him as students were not just fascinated by his ideas, they fell in love with him. One such youth was Alcibiades, the notorious playboy who became a powerful political figure near the end of the 5th century BC. In Plato's Symposium, Alcibiades describes Socrates' seductive powers by comparing him to the little figures of Silenus that were made back then. In Greek myth, Silenus was quite ugly, but also a wise prophet. Accordingly, the statues of Silenus were hollow, and when you took them apart, you would find little figures of gods inside them, the inner truth and beauty under the unappealing exterior. And so for Alcibiades, it was the same with Socrates, who was so ugly as to be repellent, but whose face radiated inner beauty and contentment. The effect was confusing and attractive. Antiquity's other great seducer, Cleopatra, also sent out mixed signals. By all accounts, physically alluring, in voice, face, body, and manner, she also had a brilliantly active mind, which for many writers of the time made her seem somewhat masculine in spirit. These contrary qualities gave her complexity, and complexity gave her power. To capture and hold attention, you need to show attributes that go against your physical appearance, creating depth and mystery. If you have a sweet face and an innocent air, let out hints of something dark, even vaguely cruel in your character. It isn't advertised in your words, but in your manner. The actor Errol Flynn had a boyishly angelic face and a slight air of sadness. Beneath this outward appearance, however, women could sense an underlying cruelty, a criminal streak, an exciting kind of dangerousness. This play of contrary qualities attracted obsessive interest. The female equivalent is the type epitomized by Marilyn Monroe. She had the face and voice of a little girl, but something sexual and naughty emanated powerfully from her as well. Madame Récamier did it all with her eyes, the gaze of an angel, suddenly interrupted by something sensual and flirtatious. Playing with gender roles is a kind of intriguing paradox that has a long history in seduction. The greatest Don Juans have had a touch of prettiness and femininity, and the most attractive courtesans have had a masculine streak. The strategy, though, is only powerful when the underquality is merely hinted at. If the mix is too obvious or striking, it will seem bizarre or even threatening. The great 17th century French courtesan, Ninon de l'Enclos, was decidedly feminine in appearance, yet everyone who met her was struck by a touch of aggressiveness and independence in her, but just a touch. The late 19th century Italian novelist, Gabriele D'Annunzio, was certainly masculine in his approaches, but there was a gentleness, a consideration mixed in, and an interest in feminine finery. The combinations can be juggled every which way. Oscar Wilde was quite feminine in appearance and manner, but the underlying suggestion that he was actually quite masculine drew both men and women to him. A potent variation on this theme is the blending of physical heat and emotional coldness. Dandies like Beau Brummel and Andy Warhol combine striking physical appearances with a kind of coldness of manner, a distance from everything and everyone. They are both enticing and elusive, and people spend lifetimes chasing after such men, trying to shatter their unattainability. The power of apparently unattainable people is devilishly seductive. We want to be the one to break them down. They also wrap themselves in ambiguity and mystery, either talking very little or talking only of surface matters, hinting at a depth of character you can never reach. When Marlene Dietrich entered a room or arrived at a party, all eyes inevitably turned to her. First, there were her startling clothes, chosen to make heads turn. Then there was her air of nonchalant indifference. Men and women, too, became obsessed with her, thinking of her long after other memories of the evening had faded. Remember, that first impression, that entrance, is critical. To show too much desire for attention is to signal insecurity and will often drive people away. Play it too cold and disinterested, on the other hand, and no one will bother coming near. The trick is to combine the two attitudes at the same moment. It is the essence of coquetry. Perhaps you have a reputation for a particular quality, which immediately comes to mind when people see you. You will better hold their attention by suggesting that behind this reputation, some other quality lies lurking. No one had a darker, more sinful reputation than Lord Byron. What drove women wild was that behind his somewhat cold and disdainful exterior, they could sense that he was actually quite romantic, even spiritual. Byron played this up with his melancholic airs and occasional kind deed. Transfixed and confused, many women thought that they could be the one to lead him back to goodness, to make him a faithful lover. Once a woman entertained such a thought, she was completely under his spell. It is not difficult to create such a seductive effect. Should you be known as eminently rational, say, hint at something irrational. Johannes, the narrator in Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, first treats the young Cordelia with businesslike politeness, as his reputation would lead her to expect. Yet she very soon overhears him making remarks that hint at a wild, poetic streak in his character, and she is excited and intrigued. These principles have applications far beyond sexual seduction. To hold the attention of a broad public, to seduce them into thinking about you, you need to mix your signals. Display too much of one quality, even if it is a noble one, like knowledge or efficiency, and people will feel that you lack humanity. We are all complex and ambiguous, full of contradictory impulses. If you show only one side, even if it is your good side, you will wear on people's nerves. They will suspect you are a hypocrite. Mahatma Gandhi, a saintly figure, openly confessed to feelings of anger and vengefulness. John F. Kennedy, the most seductive American public figure of modern times, was a walking paradox, an East Coast aristocrat with a love of the common man, an obviously masculine man, a war hero, with a vulnerability you could sense underneath, an intellectual who loved popular culture. People were drawn to Kennedy like the steel filings in Wilde's fable. A bright surface may have a decorative charm, but what draws your eye into a painting is a depth of field, an inexpressible ambiguity, a surreal complexity. Reversal. The complexity you signal to other people will only affect them properly if they have the capacity to enjoy a mystery. Some people like things simple and lack the patience to pursue a person who confuses them. They prefer to be dazzled and overwhelmed. The great Belle Époque courtesan known as La Belle Otero would work a complex magic on artists and political figures who fell for her. But in dealing with the more uncomplicated, sensual male, she would astound them with spectacle and beauty. When meeting a woman for the first time, Casanova might dress in the most fantastic outfit, with jewels and brilliant colors to dazzle the eye. He would use the target's reaction to gauge whether or not she would demand a more complicated seduction. Some of his victims, particularly young girls, needed no more than the glittering and spellbinding appearance, which was really what they wanted, and the seduction would stay on that level. Everything depends on your target. Do not bother creating depth for people who are insensitive to it, or who may even be put off or disturbed by it. You can recognize such types by their preference for the simpler pleasures in life, their lack of patience for a more nuanced story. With them, keep it simple. Chapter 4. Appear to be an object of desire. Create triangles. Few are drawn to the person whom others avoid or neglect. People gather around those who have already attracted interest. We want what other people want. To draw your victims closer and make them hungry to possess you, you must create an aura of desirability, of being wanted and courted by many. It will become a point of vanity for them to be the preferred object of your attention, to win you away from a crowd of admirers. Manufacture the illusion of popularity by surrounding yourself with members of the opposite sex, friends, former lovers, present suitors. Create triangles that stimulate rivalry and raise your value. Build a reputation that precedes you. If many have succumbed to your charms, there must be a reason. Creating triangles. One evening in 1882, the 32-year-old Prussian philosopher Paul Rey, living in Rome at the time, visited the house of an older woman who ran a salon for writers and artists. Rey noticed a newcomer there, a 21-year-old Russian girl named Lou von Salome, who had come to Rome on holiday with her mother. Rey introduced himself, and they began a conversation that lasted well into the night. Her ideas about God and morality were like his own. She talked with such intensity, yet at the same time, her eyes seemed to flirt with him. Over the next few days, Rey and Salome took long walks through the city. Intrigued by her mind, yet confused by the emotions she aroused, he wanted to spend more time with her. Then, one day, she startled him with a proposition. She knew he was a close friend of the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, then also visiting Italy. The three of them, she said, should travel together. No, actually live together, in a kind of philosopher's ménage à trois. A fierce critic of Christian morals, Rey found this idea delightful. He wrote to his friend about Salome, describing how desperate she was to meet him. After a few such letters, Nietzsche hurried to Rome. Rey had made this invitation to please Salome and to impress her. He also wanted to see if Nietzsche shared his enthusiasm for the young girl's ideas. But as soon as Nietzsche arrived, something unpleasant happened. The great philosopher, who had always been a loner, was obviously smitten with Salome. Instead of the three of them sharing intellectual conversations together, Nietzsche seemed to be conspiring to get the girl alone. When Rey caught glimpses of Nietzsche and Salome talking without including him, he felt shivers of jealousy. Forget about some philosopher's ménage à trois. Salome was his. He had discovered her, and he would not share her even with his good friend. Somehow, he had to get her alone. Only then could he woo and win her. Madame Salome had planned to escort her daughter back to Russia, but Salome wanted to stay in Europe. Rey intervened, offering to travel with the Salomes to Germany and introduce them to his own mother, whom he promised would look after the girl and act as a chaperone. Rey knew that his mother would be a lax guardian at best. Madame Salome agreed to this proposal, but Nietzsche was harder to shake. He decided to join them on their northward journey to Rey's home in Prussia. At one point in the trip, Nietzsche and Salome took a walk by themselves, and when they came back, Rey had the feeling that something physical had happened between them. His blood boiled. Salome was slipping from his grasp. Finally, the group split up, the mother returning to Russia, Nietzsche to his summer place in Tautenberg, Rey and Salome staying behind at Rey's home. But Salome did not stay long. She accepted an invitation of Nietzsche's to visit him, unchaperoned, in Tautenberg. In her absence, Rey was consumed with doubts and anger. He wanted her more than ever, and was prepared to redouble his efforts. When she finally came back, Rey vented his bitterness, railing against Nietzsche, criticizing his philosophy and questioning his motives toward the girl. But Salome took Nietzsche's side. Rey was in despair. He felt he had lost her for good. Yet a few days later, she surprised him again. She had decided she wanted to live with him, and with him alone. At last, Rey had what he had wanted, or so he thought. The couple settled in Berlin, where they rented an apartment together. But now, to Ray's dismay, the old pattern repeated. They lived together, but Salome was courted on all sides by young men. The darling of Berlin's intellectuals who admired her independent spirit, her refusal to compromise, she was constantly surrounded by a harem of men who referred to her as Her Excellency. Once again, Ray found himself competing for her attention. Driven to despair, he left her a few years later and eventually committed suicide. In 1911, Sigmund Freud met Salome, now known as Lou Andreas Salome, at a conference in Germany. She wanted to devote herself to the psychoanalytical movement, she said, and Freud found her enchanting, although, like everyone else, he knew the story of her infamous affair with Nietzsche. Salome had no background in psychoanalysis or in therapy of any kind, but Freud admitted her into the inner circle of followers who attended his private lectures. Soon after she joined the circle, one of Freud's most promising and brilliant students, Dr. Victor Tausk, 16 years younger than Salome, fell in love with her. Salome's relationship with Freud had been platonic, but he had grown extremely fond of her. He was depressed when she missed a lecture, and would send her notes and flowers. Her involvement in a love affair with Tausk made him intensely jealous, and he began to compete for her attention. Tausk had been like a son to him, but the son was threatening to steal the father's platonic lover. Soon, however, Salome left Tausk. Now her friendship with Freud was stronger than ever, and so it lasted until her death in 1937. Interpretation. Men did not just fall in love with Lou Andreas Salome. They were overwhelmed with the desire to possess her, to wrest her away from others, to be the proud owner of her body and spirit. They rarely saw her alone. She always, in some way, surrounded herself with other men. When she saw that Ray was interested in her, she mentioned her desire to meet Nietzsche. This inflamed Ray and made him want to marry her and to keep him for himself. But she insisted on meeting his friend. His letters to Nietzsche betrayed his desire for this woman, and this, in turn, kindled Nietzsche's own desire for her, even before he had met her. Every time one of the two men was alone with her, the other was in the background. Then, later on, most of the men who met her knew of the infamous Nietzsche affair, and this only increased their desire to possess her, to compete with Nietzsche's memory. Freud's affection for her, similarly, turned into potent desire when he had to vie with Tausk for her attention. Salome was intelligent and attractive enough on her own account, but her constant strategy of imposing a triangle of relationships on her suitors made her desirability intense. And while they fought over her, she had the power, being desired by all and subject to none. Our desire for another person almost always involves social considerations. We are attracted to those who are attractive to other people. We want to possess them and steal them away. You can believe all the sentimental nonsense you want to about desire, but in the end, much of it has to do with vanity and greed. Don't whine and moralize about people's selfishness, but simply use it to your advantage. The illusion that you're desired by others will make you more attractive to your victims than your beautiful face or your perfect body. And the most effective way to create that illusion is to create a triangle. Impose another person between you and your victim, and subtly make your victim aware of how much this other person wants you. The third point on the triangle doesn't have to be just one person. Surround yourself with admirers. Reveal your past conquests. In other words, envelop yourself in an aura of desirability. Make your targets compete with your past and your present. They will long to possess you all to themselves, giving you great power for as long as you elude their grasp. Fail to make yourself an object of desire right from the start, and you will end up the sorry slave to the whims of your lovers. They will abandon you the moment they lose interest. Keys to seduction. We are social creatures and are immensely influenced by the tastes and desires of other people. Imagine a large social gathering. You see a man alone whom nobody talks to for any length of time and who is wandering around without company. Isn't there a kind of self-fulfilling isolation about him? Why is he alone? Why is he avoided? There has to be a reason. Until someone takes pity on this man and starts up a conversation with him, he will look unwanted and unwantable. But over there, in another corner, is a woman surrounded by people. They laugh at her remarks, and as they laugh, others join the group, attracted by its gaiety. When she moves around, people follow. Her face is glowing with attention. There has to be a reason. In both cases, of course, there doesn't actually have to be a reason at all. The neglected man may have quite charming qualities, supposing you ever talk to him, but most likely you won't. Desirability is a social illusion. Its source is less what you say or do, or any kind of boasting or self-advertisement, than the sense that other people desire you. To turn your target's interest into something deeper, into desire, you must make them see you as a person whom others cherish and covet. Desire is both imitative, we like what others like, and competitive, we want to take away from others what they have. As children, we wanted to monopolize the attention of a parent, to draw it away from other siblings. This sense of rivalry pervades human desire, repeating throughout our lives. Make people compete for your attention. Make them see you as sought after by everyone else. The aura of desirability will envelop you. Your admirers can be friends or even suitors. Call it the harem effect. Pauline Bonaparte, sister of Napoleon, raised her value in men's eyes by always having a group of worshipful men around her at balls and parties. If she went for a walk, it was never with one man, always with two or three. Perhaps these men were simply friends, or even just props and hangers-on. The sight of them was enough to suggest that she was prized and desired, a woman worth fighting over. Andy Warhol, too, surrounded himself with the most glamorous, interesting people he could find. To be part of his inner circle meant that you were desirable as well. By placing himself in the middle but keeping himself aloof from it all, he made everyone compete for his attention. He stirred people's desire to possess him by holding back. Practices like these not only stimulate competitive desires, they take aim at people's prime weakness, their vanity and self-esteem. We can endure feeling that another person has more talent or more money, but the sense that a rival is more desirable than we are, that is unbearable. In the early 18th century, the Duc de Richelieu, a great rake, managed to seduce a young woman who was rather religious, but whose husband, a dolt, was often away. He then proceeded to seduce her upstairs neighbor, a young widow. When the two women discovered that he was going from one to the other in the same night, they confronted him. A lesser man would have fled, but not the Duke. He understood the dynamic of vanity and desire. Neither woman wanted to feel that he preferred the other, and so he managed to arrange a ménage à trois, knowing that now they would struggle between themselves to be the favorite. When people's vanity is at risk, you can make them do whatever you want. According to Stendhal, if there is a woman you are interested in, pay attention to her sister. That will stir a triangular desire. Your reputation, your illustrious past as a seducer, is an effective way of creating an aura of desirability. Women threw themselves at Errol Flynn's feet, not because of his handsome face, and certainly not because of his acting skills, but because of his reputation. They knew that other women had found him irresistible. Once he had established that reputation, he didn't have to chase women anymore. They came to him. Men who believe that a rakish reputation will make women fear or distrust them and should be played down are quite wrong. On the contrary, it makes them more attractive. The virtuous Duchess de Montpensier, the Grande Mademoiselle of 17th century France, began by enjoying a friendship with the rake Lauzun, but a troubling thought soon occurred to her. If a man with Lauzun's past did not see her as a possible lover, something had to be wrong with her. This anxiety eventually pushed her into his arms. To be part of a great seducer's club of conquests can be a matter of vanity and pride. We are happy to be in such company, to have our name broadcast as this man or woman's lover. Your own reputation may not be so alluring, but you must find a way to suggest to your victim that others, many others, have found you desirable. It's reassuring. There's nothing like a restaurant full of empty tables to persuade you not to go in. A variation on the triangle strategy is the use of contrasts. Careful exploitation of people who are dull or unattractive may enhance your desirability by comparison. At a social affair, for instance, make sure that your target has to chat with the most boring person available. Come to the rescue, and your target will be delighted to see you. In The Seducer's Diary by Soren Kierkegaard, Johannes has designs on the innocent young Cordelia. Knowing that his friend Edward is hopelessly shy and dull, he encourages this man to court her. A few weeks of Edward's attentions will make her eyes wander in search of someone else, anyone else, and Johannes will make sure that they settle on him. Johannes chose to strategize and maneuver, but almost any social environment will contain contrasts you can make use of almost naturally. The 17th century English actress Nell Gwynn became the main mistress of King Charles II because her humor and unaffectedness made her that much more desirable among the many stiff and pretentious ladies of Charles's court. When the Shanghai actress Jiang Qing met Mao Zedong in 1937, she didn't have to do much to seduce him. The other women in his mountain camp in Yan'an dressed like men and were decidedly unfeminine. The sight alone of Jiang was enough to seduce Mao, who soon left his wife for her. To make use of contrasts, either develop and display those attractive attributes, humor, vivacity, and so on, that are the scarcest in your own social group, or choose a group in which your natural qualities are rare and will shine. The use of contrasts has vast political ramifications, for a political figure must also seduce and seem desirable. Learn to play up the qualities that your rivals lack. Peter II, Tsar in 18th century Russia, was arrogant and irresponsible, so his wife, Catherine the Great, did all she could to seem modest and dependable. When Vladimir Lenin returned to Russia in 1917 after Tsar Nicholas II had been deposed, he made a show of decisiveness and discipline, precisely what no other leader had at the time. In the American presidential race of 1980, the irresoluteness of Jimmy Carter made the single-mindedness of Ronald Reagan look desirable. Contrasts are eminently seductive because they don't depend on your own words or self-advertisements. The public reads them unconsciously and sees what it wants to see. Finally, appearing to be desired by others will raise your value, but often how you carry yourself can influence this as well. Do not let your targets see you so often. Keep your distance, seem unattainable, out of their reach. An object that is rare and hard to obtain is generally more prized. Reversal. There is no reversal. It is essential to appear desirable in the eyes of others. Chapter 5. Create a need. Stir anxiety and discontent. A perfectly satisfied person cannot be seduced. Tension and disharmony must be instilled in your target's minds. Stir within them feelings of discontent and unhappiness with their circumstances and with themselves. Their life lacks adventure. They have strayed from the ideals of their youth. They have become boring. The feelings of inadequacy that you create will give you space to insinuate yourself, to make them see you as the answer to their problems. Pain and anxiety are the proper precursors to pleasure. Learn to manufacture the need that you can fill. Opening a wound. In the coal mining town of Eastwood in central England, David Herbert Lawrence was considered something of a strange lad. Pale and delicate, he had no time for games or boyish pursuits, but was interested in literature, and he preferred the company of girls, who made up most of his friends. Lawrence often visited the Chambers family, who had been his neighbors until they moved out of Eastwood to a farm not far away. He liked to study with the Chambers sisters, particularly Jessie. She was shy and serious, and getting her to open up and confide in him was a pleasurable challenge. Jessie grew quite attached to Lawrence over the years, and they became good friends. One day, in 1906, Lawrence, 21 at the time, did not show up at the usual hour for his study session with Jessie. He finally arrived much later, in a mood she had never seen before, preoccupied and quiet. Now it was her turn to make him open up. Finally, he talked. He felt she was getting too close to him. What about her future? Whom would she marry? Certainly not him, he said, for they were just friends. But it was unfair of him to keep her from seeing others. They should, of course, remain friends and have their talks, but maybe less often. When he finished and left, she felt a strange emptiness. She had yet to think much about love or marriage. Suddenly, she had doubts. What would her future be? Why wasn't she thinking about it? She felt anxious and upset, without understanding why. Lawrence continued to visit, but everything had changed. He criticized her for this and that. She wasn't very physical. What kind of wife would she make anyway? A man needed more from a woman than just talk. He likened her to a nun. They began to see each other less often. When, sometime later, Lawrence accepted a teaching position at a school outside London, she felt part relieved to be rid of him for a while. But when he said goodbye to her, and intimated that it might be for the last time, she broke down and cried. Then he started sending her weekly letters. He would write about girls he was seeing. Maybe one of them would be his wife. Finally, at his behest, she visited him in London. They got along well, as in the old times, but he continued to badger her about her future, picking at that old wound. At Christmas, he was back in Eastwood, and when he visited her, he seemed exultant. He had decided that it was Jessie he should marry, that he had, in fact, been attracted to her all along. They should keep it quiet for a while, although his writing career was taking off, his first novel was about to be published, he needed to make more money. Caught off guard by this sudden announcement and overwhelmed with happiness, Jessie agreed to everything, and they became lovers. Soon, however, the familiar pattern repeated. Criticisms, breakups, announcements that he was engaged to another girl. This only deepened his hold on her. It was not until 1912 that she finally decided never to see him again, disturbed by his portrayal of her in the autobiographical novel Sons and Lovers. But Lawrence remained a lifelong obsession for her. In 1913, a young Englishwoman named Ivy Lowe, who had read Lawrence's novels, began to correspond with him, her letters gushing with admiration. By now, Lawrence was married to a German woman, the Baroness Frieda von Richthofen. To Lowe's surprise, though, he invited her to visit him and his wife in Italy. She knew he was probably something of a Don Juan, but was eager to meet him and accepted his invitation. Lawrence was not what she had expected. His voice was high-pitched, His eyes were piercing, and there was something vaguely feminine about him. Soon they were taking walks together, with Lawrence confiding in Lo. She felt that they were becoming friends, which delighted her. Then suddenly, just before she was to leave, he launched into a series of criticisms of her. She was so unspontaneous, so predictable, less human being than robot. Devastated by this unexpected attack, she nevertheless had to agree what he had said was true. What could he have seen in her in the first place? Who was she, anyway? Lo left Italy feeling empty, but then Lawrence continued to write to her as if nothing had happened. She soon realized that she had fallen hopelessly in love with him, despite everything he had said to her. Or was it not despite what he had said, but because of it? In 1914, the writer John Middleton Murray received a letter from Lawrence, a good friend of his. In the letter, out of nowhere, Lawrence criticized Middleton Murray for being passionless and not gallant enough with his wife, the novelist Catherine Mansfield. Middleton Murray later wrote, quote, "I had never felt for a man before what his letter made me feel for him. It was a new thing, a unique thing in my experience, and it was to remain unique," unquote. He felt that beneath Lawrence's criticisms lay some weird kind of affection. Whatever he saw Lawrence from then on, he felt a strange physical attraction that he could not explain. Interpretation. The number of women and of men who fell under Lawrence's spell is astonishing, given how unpleasant he could be. In almost every case, the relationship began in friendship with frank talks, exchanges of confidences, a spiritual bond. Then, invariably, he would suddenly turn against them, voicing harsh personal criticisms. He would know them well by that time, and the criticisms were often quite accurate and hit a nerve. This would inevitably trigger confusion in his victims and a sense of anxiety, a feeling that something was wrong with them. Jolted out of their usual sense of normality, they would feel divided inside. With half of their minds, they wondered why he was doing this and felt he was unfair. With the other half, they believed it was all true. Then, in those moments of self-doubt, they would get a letter or a visit from him, in which he was his old, charming self. Now they saw him differently. Now they were weak and vulnerable, in need of something, and he would seem so strong. Now he drew them to him, feelings of friendship turning into affection and desire. Once they felt uncertain about themselves, they were susceptible to falling in love. Most of us protect ourselves from the harshness of life by succumbing to routines and patterns, by closing ourselves off from others. But underlying these habits is a tremendous sense of insecurity and defensiveness. We feel we are not really living. The seducer must pick at this wound and bring these semi-conscious thoughts into full awareness. This was what Lawrence did. His sudden, brutally unexpected jabs would hit people at their weak spot. Although Lawrence had great success with his frontal approach, it's often better to stir thoughts of inadequacy and uncertainty indirectly, by hinting at comparisons to yourself or to others, and by insinuating somehow that your victims' lives are less grand than they had imagined. You want them to feel at war with themselves, torn in two directions, and anxious about it. Anxiety, a feeling of lack and need, is the precursor of all desire. These jolts in the victim's mind create space for you to insinuate your poison, the siren call of adventure or fulfillment that will make them follow you into your web. Without anxiety and a sense of lack, there can be no seduction. Keys to seduction. Everyone wears a mask in society. We pretend to be more sure of ourselves than we are. We don't want other people to glimpse that doubting self within us. In truth, our egos and personalities are much more fragile than they appear to be. They cover up feelings of confusion and emptiness. As a seducer, you must never mistake a person's appearance for the reality. People are always susceptible to being seduced because, in fact, everyone lacks a sense of completeness, feels something missing deep inside. Bring their doubts and anxieties to the surface, and they can be led and lured to follow you. No one can see you as someone to follow or fall in love with unless they first reflect on themselves somehow and on what they're missing. Before the seduction proceeds, you must place a mirror in front of them in which they glimpse that inner emptiness. Made aware of a lack, they now can focus on you as the person who can fill that empty space. Remember, most of us are lazy. To relieve our feelings of boredom or inadequacy on our own takes too much effort. Letting someone else do the job is both easier and more exciting. The desire to have someone fill up our emptiness is the weakness on which all seducers prey. Make people anxious about the future. Make them depressed. Make them question their identity. Make them sense the boredom that gnaws at their life. The ground is prepared. The seeds of seduction can be sown. In Plato's Dialogue Symposium, the West's oldest treatise on love, and a text that has had a determining influence on our ideas of desire, the courtesan Diotima explains to Socrates the parentage of Eros, the god of love. Eros's father was contrivance or cunning, and his mother was poverty or need. Eros takes after his parents. He is constantly in need, which he is constantly contriving to fill. As the god of love, he knows that love cannot be induced in another person unless they too feel need. And that is what his arrows do. Piercing people's flesh, they make them feel a lack, an ache, a hunger. This is the essence of your task as a seducer. Like Eros, you must create a wound in your victim, aiming at their soft spot, the chink in their self-esteem. If they're stuck in a rut, make them feel it more deeply, innocently bringing it up and talking about it. What you want is a wound, an insecurity you can expand a little, an anxiety that can best be relieved by involvement with another person, namely you. They must feel the wound before they fall in love. Notice how Lawrence stirred anxiety, always hitting at his victim's weak spot. For Jesse Chambers, her physical coldness. For Ivy Lowe, her lack of spontaneity. For Middleton Murray, his lack of gallantry. Cleopatra got Julius Caesar to sleep with her the first night he met her. But the real seduction, the one that made him her slave, began later. In their ensuing conversations, she talked repeatedly of Alexander the Great, the hero from whom she was supposedly descended. No one could compare to him. By implication, Caesar was made to feel inferior. Understanding that beneath his bravado, Caesar was insecure, Cleopatra awakened in him an anxiety, a hunger to prove his greatness. Once he felt this way, he was easily further seduced. Doubts about his masculinity was his tender spot. When Caesar was assassinated, Cleopatra turned her sights on Mark Antony, one of Caesar's successors in the leadership of Rome. Antony loved pleasure and spectacle, and his tastes were crude. She appeared to him first on her royal barge, then wined and dined and banqueted him. Everything was geared to suggest to him the superiority of the Egyptian way of life over the Roman, at least when it came to pleasure. The Romans were boring and unsophisticated by comparison, and once Antony was made to feel how much he was missing in spending his time with his dull soldiers and his matronly Roman wife, he could be made to see Cleopatra as the incarnation of all that was exciting. He became her slave. This is the lure of the exotic. In your role of seducer, Try to position yourself as coming from the outside, as a stranger of sorts. You represent change, difference, a breakup of routines. Make your victims feel that, by comparison, their lives are boring and their friends less interesting than they had thought. Lawrence made his targets feel personally inadequate. If you